Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Should America be afraid of bad teachers? As in past scares over so-called welfare queens and crack babies, my guest says our worries about the effect bad teachers have to damage society have risen to the level of moral panic. Meanwhile, very modern-sounding calls for teacher accountability, merit pay, and more effective discipline have all been tried before in the effort to close the student achievement gap, with largely uninspiring results. After tracing nearly two centuries of public school teaching in America, education journalist Dana Goldstein has come to some interesting conclusions about what teachers themselves can and cannot do to change the quality of education. Her new book is called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. She joins us today as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative. Dana, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me.
Why are Americans so ambivalent about teachers?
I think it really has to do with the contrast between our high expectations for teachers and what looks like consistently disappointing results. So I really look back in the book at this idea that teachers can close inequality gaps between the middle class and the poor and even solve for poverty. And these ideas came to the fore, especially in 2008, 2009, as the recession hit. And I found that we've had these ideas since the early 19th century, that we've expected teachers to close gaps between Catholics and Protestants, between new immigrants and the American mainstream, between Black and white children. And today we really talk about it in terms of class, between the middle class and the poor. And because these gaps in academic achievement between these different groups are quite persistent over time, we are consistently disappointed. And we say to teachers, how come you're failing to fulfill this goal that we've set for you as a society?
How are teachers themselves feeling about the profession these days?
Some of the recent polls of American teachers show that there is a negativity, that teachers say that they're not happy in their current job, although they're very passionate about the overall career of teaching. So I wanted to look at the question of, you know, if teachers are feeling, the majority of teachers are feeling specifically negative at this time, why is that?
All right, let's talk about how we got here in the first place. How did Americans come to agree that it was in the country's best interest to at least offer a basic education to everyone who lives here?
Well, it wasn't something that was discussed very much prior to about the 1830s. And that's when you see the flowering of this first big national school reform movement. It's called the Common Schools Movement. We often associate it with Horace Mann, who was the first Secretary of Education in any American state in Massachusetts. And particularly, there was the idea that we needed to educate our citizens for democracy, that in order to have educated voters who were going to go out to the voting booths each year and make good choices in terms of their political representatives, you would have to make sure that people are literate, that they can do basic math. And more than that, really, the way it's discussed at the time is that children need a moral education. And these were ideas that really came from Calvinist Protestantism, which, of course, was, you know, the dominant religion in early 19th century America. And there was increasing Catholic immigration to the United States at this time in the 1830s. And there was a huge concern about that. And there was the idea that we needed to make sure that Protestant teachers were in front of children, making sure that they're Americanizing them with the right moral values.
Was there also, there was also a class distinction in many cases between new Catholic immigrants and Protestants who had been in the country for some time?
Yeah, certainly. And the early education reformers, people like Horace Mann and also Catherine Beecher, who I write quite a lot about in the book, she was Harriet Beecher Stowe's sister. So, of course, from the strong abolitionist Protestant family, you know, they were upper middle class or affluent people. And they did have a concern about how the character of this early American society was changing with increased working class Catholic immigration.
So education thinkers wanted to provide an education that would allow people to function in a democracy. They wanted to provide a sort of moral education. How did that shape the kinds of subject matter that was taught in school?
That's a really important question, because what ends up happening is that they decide that the teachers for this big push into compulsory schooling should be women. In part because they believe that women are very moral and angelic and they're going to give the right values to children more than men will, but also because you could, of course, pay women about 50% less to do the same work. And people then wanted to raise taxes about as much as people now want to raise taxes, which is to say not at all. They didn't want to raise taxes to achieve compulsory schooling. So what happens is that these very young girls with only the equivalent of about a modern sixth or seventh grade education are often being recruited to attend normal schools, teacher training colleges at the time, and they really undergo a very quick training period, many of them 1 or 2 years, and then they're in the classroom. And as a result of this, this is not an intellectual push for public education. It's really more about the moral values that the teacher can impart to the students, in part because the teachers themselves were not that highly educated.
Yeah, I remember as a kid reading about Laura Ingalls teaching school when she was 15 years old and not really understanding how that was possible, but I guess she wasn't so unusual for her time and place.
No, she wasn't. And I talk about girls as young as 13, 14 teaching in rural schoolhouses in the book, and that was quite typical.
And, you know, that sounds like a really different mission than we have for schools today, right? Today we focus on the employability of people after they finish a public school education.
Yeah, those ideas really came to the fore in the early 20th century in the Progressive Era and have become again very popular today. But one of the things the points that I always like to make is how our expectations on students have changed and how that leads to the way we think about teaching. Because, of course, when in the 19th century we talked about the most important thing for the child was getting a moral education, today we have this concept of college for all. The idea that every single child is going to achieve great academic achievements. And so really, this is a major, major shift, and we often don't acknowledge how high our expectations have been raised.
You mentioned, Dana, that female teachers could be paid less than men, and part of the reason they could was not only sexism, but the idea that they were doing this for moral and spiritual reasons, and so it would be sort of untoward to ask for a fair living wage.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. And it's often discussed as sort of the missionary teacher ideal, the idea that you're not going to complain about the conditions of the labor because you're just so driven to do this work. You're passionate about it. You have almost a religious zeal for providing education to children. I think that actually that has stayed with us very much. If you think about a program like Teach for America, which recruits elite young college graduates to teach in high poverty schools, that missionary language floats around still, and it's still part of our debate.
So is that a good thing or a bad thing? You know, you might meet an attorney who says, I don't love the job, but it pays really well. Teachers, they often can't say it pays really well, so they have to say they love the work.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's important to acknowledge that many teachers and certainly many of the best teachers feel a calling to do the work, and it's something they may have imagined themselves doing since they themselves were children, and they can't imagine doing anything else, and they do love it and are mission-driven. At the same time, this sort of angelic missionary teacher ideal at the cultural or political level, which I discuss in the book, I think there have been some, you know, negative ramifications there, which is that we don't talk enough about teacher pay, about working conditions for teachers. And ultimately, teachers are workers that are doing a job. And if we ignore all of those sort of pragmatic concerns, we're going to end up with not a very realistic public discourse about what we can expect from teachers and what teachers' work is actually like.
Before the rise of organized labor, what kinds of, and I'm using air quotes here, moral turpitude could get a teacher fired from her job?
Well, getting pregnant, whether or not she was married, that was a big one. You didn't want children asking questions about how the baby got in there, which is kind of a funny thing if you think about it. I'm sure that the children were exposed to all sorts of pregnant women outside of the classroom. You know, being Quaker, being anti-war, being Black, being Jewish, opposing the mayor's political agenda, you know, not having family that is connected politically in the city or town where you live. All of these things were very common reasons to fire a teacher.
And people also were spun up for a while about communism in the teaching force.
Absolutely. So from the 1930s till about 1960, there was wave after wave of these Red Scare witch hunts of left-wing teachers. Some of the teachers were actually Communist Party members, but some of them weren't. They were people who may have had an intellectual interest in the Soviet Union, folks who opposed World War I or World War II for maybe socialist reasons, or they were pacifists. So I trace that in the book. Thousands and thousands of teachers across their countries did lose their job in these Red Scares.
In the early 20th century, then, teachers began to see organizing as essential to their survival within the profession. Can you talk about the kinds of protections that they sought?
Well, so teachers' unionism dates back to about 1897 in Chicago. And at the time, reformers who were led by William Rainey Harper, the president of the University of Chicago, they became very concerned about this feminization of the teaching profession, that teaching had become so female. And with the influx of immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe at the turn of the 20th century, there were urban classroom sizes of 60 or 70 kids. And there was this idea that these young female teachers, who of course were there because of the earlier policies in the early 19th century that specifically aimed to bring people like that into the classroom, there was now a concern in about 1900 that they weren't tough enough, that they lacked the masculinity to really control these huge class sizes. So what teachers were asking for in terms of their early union movement was some of the things that we still talk about today. They wanted lower class sizes. They wanted retirement pensions. They wanted protection to make sure that as they, you know, gained more experience and got paid more, that they wouldn't be fired to bring in yet more younger people. And an additional thing that was new then that we don't have today is that male teachers were getting paid more than female teachers still in the early 20th century. And the unions opposed this, and it was something they effectively organized to end.
And in fact, male teachers were paid more than female teachers in a really blatant way. It wasn't kept under wraps. This was just something that was accepted.
Right. And it was even more blatant than just being accepted. But there was actually reformers who pushed policies where you would explicitly lower the salaries of female teachers and use that money to then recruit more men to the profession to pay them more. So they were literally taking from Jane to pay Joe.
Did the fact that the teaching profession was populated largely by women by the time of the early 20th century, was that a disincentive to men? Did they somehow feel like they shouldn't lower themselves to do what they perceived to be women's work?
I think absolutely there was a cultural feeling like that. But in addition, there was the rise of the manufacturing economy and the rise of blue-collar organized labor. So often a man could do much better, you know, working in a factory job in terms of salary than he could have if he had taught public school. And, you know, up until the 1960s, we see teachers earning as little in New York City, for example, as $66 per week. And this is less than a car washer might have been able to earn in New York City at the time. So the pay for teachers were low, and that is a reason why men often did not want to do the job.
And collective bargaining did, in fact, raise wages. I mean, teachers aren't getting rich today, but they do better than they might have 100 years ago.
Yeah, the collective bargaining for teachers, which really explodes in the 60s and 70s, is the force that leads teaching to be a squarely middle-class profession that it is today.
Did anybody intend to make it so hard in many school systems to fire teachers who couldn't or wouldn't get the job done?
Sorry, can you repeat the question?
The intentions of the protections from collective bargaining, nobody thought they would lead, am I right, to making it nearly impossible in some places to fire teachers who are not performing.
Yeah, so if you go back to 1909 and the push for tenure, which starts in New Jersey and kind of spreads from there to places like New York City and Chicago and eventually all across the country, even in places in the South where teachers do not have collective bargaining rights. They're looking over at Germany at the time, and they're noticing that in Germany, teachers are considered more prestigious, that more men want to do the job, and in general, it's just a more respected profession, and they see that teachers have tenure in Germany. And this is an idea that good government reformers and unions actually agree about. But what happens very quickly, you know, in the years after tenure is first instituted is this realization that while actually it's not just going to protect the Quaker teacher or the Black teacher or the pregnant teacher, it's going to protect teachers that are ineffective. And so, you know, very early on, say in the 1920s, there's already a concern that we've gone too far with tenure and we need to roll it back. And this is just a debate we've been having perennially since then.
My guest is education journalist Dana Goldstein, a staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of the new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. You can be part of our conversation now by calling in to 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with education journalist Dana Goldstein, author of the new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. If you'd like to be part of the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372, email think@kera.org, or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. Dana, I'd like to go back in time just a little bit so you can tell us more about the fascinating Catherine Beecher, who for multiple reasons is interesting, but she was like the Jeffrey Canada of her day, right? She was everywhere talking about education and people were paying attention to what she thought.
Yes, I call her the nation's first media darling school reformer. So she really went all around the country advocating for women to become public school teachers. And it was a radical idea in the 1830s when she starts making this argument publicly, because most people were just not used to middle-class white women having any sort of public role in society, any job outside the home.
It's interesting because it became, on the one hand, it was really a feminist act to get women into the classroom, but their presence in the classroom caused many men to think of this as a less than respectable profession.
Yeah, and the tension there is such an interesting one. And Catherine Beecher herself did not support women's suffrage, so we couldn't really think of her as a feminist, so to speak, although she was interested in women having a role to play in society beyond that of a wife or a mother, because her own fiancé passed away. And she realized that she was never going to marry, and she embraced public school teaching as something useful, interesting, and intellectual that women could do, including herself. However, the argument that she makes, and she does this in part to appeal to men, is that women are well-suited to be teachers because they're almost biologically predisposed to spend time with children. So she argues that the mother is the teacher in the home, and the public school teacher is, you know, the mother at school. And it's really the ideal of the mother teacher that these are sort of one role that women are well suited and biologically predisposed to play.
At what point did the achievement gap between students of different racial groups or different socioeconomic classes start to really be notable to many Americans and be considered something that ought to be tackled?
Well, we've always been concerned about gaps between the races and classes in terms of outcomes and behavior and all of these other things. But when we really start to measure it, and when we really start to talk about in terms of test scores, which is how we think about it today, it dates back to about the 1950s or 1960s.
And yeah, testing feels like something that's only come up in the past couple of decades. But in fact, we have been trying in various ways to get some kind of objective measure of teacher performance and student accountability for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, in the earlier 20th century, to be certain, there were tests, but they were generally these IQ tests. And it was the idea that you were actually reading into the child's, you know, natural state of being, and you were going to be able to predict at age 10 or 12 their kind of lifetime ability to whether they were going to be a lawyer or a worker in a factory. You know, by the mid-20th century, there's a different idea, which is that we're going to test achievement and we're going to hold adults responsible for taking the kid that might be the son of the factory owner and turning him into the lawyer. So, you know, that's the idea that we have with us today.
And let's talk about, of course, we have a long and rather shameful history of segregated education in this country. But how did Black leaders in particular look at education? And tell us a little bit about some of the debates that took place within the African-American community about the best ways to educate students.
I trace this back to the years after the Civil War in the book, and I look at educators like W.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, Anna Julia Cooper. What I find is that where they all agree with each other is that education is just the most important thing in the African-American community in the years after the Civil War, that it is going to be the way to, quote-unquote, uplift the race. That's the term that they use. And very much like Catherine Beecher or Horace Mann in the white community, these Black educational theorists embrace the idea of a missionary teacher. They encourage educated Black people in the North to go South and to become teachers, to teach the children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren of slaves and help uplift them and help them achieve a middle-class life. Where they differ is in the role of the teacher. you know, Booker T. Washington really sees that it's okay if a teacher gets sort of more of a vocational education and then becomes a teacher of children. Anna Julia Cooper and W.E.B. Du Bois, they see teachers as part of what Du Bois calls the talented tenth, and they argue that teachers ought to be college educated. And there are similar debates going on among white educational theorists at the time, but, you know, we're still very much having this conversation, you know, to what extent should education for our neediest kids prepare them for a job, or should we be focused more on the intellectual and the academic and the idea of a liberal arts curriculum?
And these days, of course, we struggle a lot with keeping really good teachers in schools where many students are struggling.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up because it's something that after looking at the long history of the social science on teachers that I really came to believe was most key. And it's the idea of retaining our best teachers in the schools where the neediest kids are. We know that only about 7% of the current achievement gap between poor and middle class kids is driven by differences in teacher quality between schools. But that's not to say that we couldn't close some of those gaps if we were, in fact, systematically moving the best teachers to the kids who need them most. And economists have estimated that over half of the achievement gap could close if the best teachers were consistently in front of the kids that need them, the kids who are poor and have low test scores. However, our system is not set up to do that. We see that where the neediest kids are, we have the lowest teacher retention, the worst working conditions for teachers, and teachers fleeing these schools, usually after a few years. And this is one of the big problems I address toward the end of the book.
And it's not that people haven't tried. You talk about, you know, $20,000 bonuses offered to top teachers to teach in some of the struggling schools, and only a small percentage of them are even willing to apply.
Yes, only about a quarter of teachers in one federal experiment wanted that $20,000 to move to a higher poverty school, which is quite sad. But if you look at surveys of teachers and you ask high-performing teachers what could make you take on a more challenging job working with needier kids, they'll say stuff like, working conditions really matter to me, so I would really like to be in a school with a great principal. That turns out to be sort of the number one driver of whether teachers want to work someplace, and it's not surprising when you think about it. And yet, when you look at low-income schools, there's very high principal turnover in addition to high teacher turnover. So, you know, I talk about one school in Los Angeles in the book, Crenshaw High School, that had something like 30 administrators over the course of 5 or 7 years. And when you have this sort of chronic instability in high-poverty schools, it becomes really difficult to attract talent. I mean, any of us know if you're working for a company where your boss is constantly changing, it's usually not a very good working environment. And so the question is, why is that? You know, why are these schools not better places to work over the long haul?
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Ernie in Fort Worth. Hi, Ernie. Will you turn off your radio, please?
Yeah, that was the speaker to drive.
Okay.
God, I'm just amazed how terrific your guest is. Thank you so much for your interest in education. There's an organization in North Texas called Score Go in the Classroom that honor outstanding teachers in all curriculums, including coaches at big sporting events like the Dallas Stars and football games and the symphony and opera. How do you feel about nationwide that teachers should really be recognized as the true heroes of our community?
Thanks for your call.
I think this is a wonderful point, and I often make this joke, teachers are people too. And what I mean by that is that teachers seek recognition for their work, not just with children, with whom they spend the majority of their day, but also in the adult world. Like any of the rest of us, they would like to be recognized among their adult peers as leaders. I think these sort of National Teacher of the Year award programs are great, and they're a great reminder that great teachers are out there. But what interests me more on the policy level that I think is something that can drive systemic change is recognition for good teachers within the schools in which they work. You know, the teacher career path is very flat. There's not a lot of opportunities for teachers to gain recognition and take on new responsibilities other than just becoming principals, say. And a lot of great teachers have no desire to do human resources and logistics and budgets and all those other things principals do. So one of the things I suggest in the book is that we allow teachers to get paid more and get recognition by mentoring their peers, by writing the curriculum, and taking on other leadership roles within their schools.
It did strike me as you wrote about famous Americans who have been teachers, people like Thoreau and Melville and LBJ and Susan B. Anthony. Each of them is better known for whatever they did after they left the classroom than for teaching.
Yeah, and that's such an important point. And these were people who were very ambitious and felt that they had to leave education in order to exercise that ambition. And That's exactly what the caller is speaking about, which I agree with.
We have an email here, or rather a tweet from Evan, who says, calling teaching a squarely middle-class profession is a bold statement in Texas. Is it a squarely middle-class profession?
Well, I can report on the median salary across the country for teachers, which is about $54,000 per year. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, middle class. If you look at the whole range of incomes that are out there in the United States economy, I'd love to hear more about what the median income is for a teacher in Texas.
Does teacher pay really matter in terms of the quality of human beings that we get at the front of classrooms?
I think it undoubtedly does matter. And, you know, I live in New York City, and a teacher can earn a nice six-figure salary here in New York City. I saw in Dallas that a top-of-the-ladder teacher can earn about $90,000 per year, and that's not bad at all. But the question is, how long does it take to get there? You know, in North Carolina, it takes 15 years for a teacher to earn a $10,000 raise, just from about $30,000 to $40,000. You know, we're not offering teachers the opportunity to excel earlier in their careers when they're making these decisions about whether to stay or not. We're not bringing forward those raises to the time when people are making big decisions about their lives. You know, do I want to stick with this?
My guest is Dana Goldstein. You want to get a sip of water there and I'll reset here. My guest is journalist Dana Goldstein. She's a staff writer at the Marshall Project. We're talking about her new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. One of the things that teachers are really concerned about these days is the focus on high-stakes testing. What would it take to turn testing, you know, to not eliminate it altogether, but to put it back in what most people involved in education feel is its most appropriate place?
That's a great question, and it's very important to make the point that any functional education system is going to have testing. But what we've done in the past 10 years or so is we've set up our testing systems not to find out what kids know and what kids can do and how to help kids, but really to judge teachers and to figure out if teachers are quote-unquote effective is usually the term that's used. And so I report from districts in the book that are doing standardized tests in art and music and gym class and theater class. And it's really not research on how kids learn and how to help kids that's driving this testing push. You know, I think the right way to use testing is you want to use diagnostic testing to see what a child knows at the beginning of the year of the semester. You want to test again at the end to see if you have effectively taught them that. And you want to use test scores to direct instruction toward children. So teachers need to see, you know, am I getting this concept across? Did the kids learn fractions? If they didn't, I need to go back to the drawing board and focus with those students who haven't absorbed the concept. I need to try something new in my instruction. You know, right now the systems are not necessarily set up to use testing in that way, which is backed by research as the proper way to use tests.
You talk about the importance in the book as a solution to some of the problems we have in education, the importance of recruiting more men and more people of color. Can you talk about what makes diversity at the front of the classroom such a vital element of really teaching our children what they need to know?
Absolutely. I mean, there's good research showing that often teachers of color do have this additional impact with students of color, that they understand something of their students' home lives. But I think it goes beyond that, especially if you're talking about bringing men into the profession. It's hard to imagine how we're going to culturally build our respect for the teaching profession if it remains thought of as, you know, only something that some people do. And the fact of the matter is that 76% of teachers are women. And it's hard not to draw the conclusion from that, that many of the fights we have about whether teachers get paid too much or, you know, are they really lazy and they're just in it for the summers off? You know, I think bringing a more diverse group of professionals into the job can help us really see the profession for what it is, which is so crucial to every single kid and so crucial for our society.
Do we need to rethink the summers off, given that most students in this country are not operating on an agrarian calendar?
Well, actually, when the agrarian calendar was in place, kids went to school for 6 weeks in the winter and 6 weeks in the summer, because those were, you know, not the times of the year when they were needed in the fields. So we have shifted since then. But I do think, you know, there's a lot of places that are doing great things with, you know, year-round school or Saturday classes and kind of playing with the schedule. But I think what's important to acknowledge is that teachers actually work longer hours during the school year itself than most of us white-collar professionals who sit behind a desk most of the day. You know, just to deliver a one-hour lesson to kids, you really are spending many hours planning that lesson, and then, of course, you have all those papers to grade afterward. So I think it's a bit of a misconception that teachers don't work as hard as other folks. And yes, they do get the summer off, and that is a nice benefit for them. But, you know, most of great effective teachers I know and I have interviewed as a journalist are putting in more hours during the week than the rest of us.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Doug in Rockwall. Hi, Doug.
Yes, hi. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Good. I have a question for you this afternoon. Mm-hmm. It struck me, I have three teenagers, actually 21, 20, and 19. They're a little past teenage years, but I have a lot of kids moving through my house. There's a young man that had a 34 on the ACT. We all know that's a fine score. But when I asked him about the invention of the printing press, the Battle of Hastings, the Norman Conquest, even something as recent as World War II, what I discovered was, it was one-on-one. I wasn't trying to embarrass him. But there's a distinct lack of what I call cultural literacy. Now, E.D. Hirsch has written two books on this, talking about the 5,000 or so nuggets of information that, at a minimum, that one has to have to be culturally literate in our society. The question for the guest is, to what extent is there room for good old-fashioned cultural literacy? In other words, a liberal arts-oriented view of the world that puts them in a culturally literate position. I'll take the answer off here.
Thanks for your call, Doug. And in fact, if you would hold on for a second, Dana, we're going to take a quick break here and then we'll come back after the break and you can respond to Doug's question. My guest this hour is education journalist Dana Goldstein. She's a staff writer at the Marshall Project, and she's the author of a new book called The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. If you want to jump in on this, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can send email to think@kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering a new certificate program in project management November 3rd through 7th on the SMU campus. Information at smu.edu/project-management.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Dana Goldstein about her book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Join us at 1-800-933-5372, which is where we heard from Doug, Dana, who wanted to know whether there is time to fit cultural literacy into school days.
I think the concept of cultural literacy has become much less controversial than it was, say, in the 1980s or 1990s, in part because we have African-American education theorists like Lisa Delpit making the point that, you know, even for our disadvantaged kids, especially for our disadvantaged kids, having them be part of the mainstream culture and actually explicitly teaching it to them is very important, as long as we're acknowledging that the sort of culture that we want all children to know is not just Western, it's not just white culture, of course. And this is really one of the ideas that's behind the Common Core, the new shared curriculum standards that most states, although not all states, have chosen to adopt. You know, those standards are really full of this idea.
Back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Susan on the line in Dallas. Hi, Susan.
Hey, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
Yeah, I was wondering about teacher reviews and how those typically work. I mean, on some level, it seems to me that shouldn't the people who are reviewing the teachers be the ones who are, you know, benefiting from their knowledge, i.e. the students and parents? I know a lot of times there's, I mean, teachers don't get paid enough, in my opinion, especially in Texas, but there seems to be a better way of reviewing performance, you know, minus tenure and all that other kind of stuff. I mean, I mean, I'm even just doing it from past experience. One of my son's teachers last year was just, in comparison to his subject matter teacher this year, no comparison. I mean, the guy just bends over backwards and is just, you know, I would rate him a 10 and the other guy maybe a 5. Hmm. Should that account for something?
Yeah, I think it should. And actually, I think Dallas is one of the districts that's experimenting with students actually filling out surveys on how well they believe their teachers are doing. And there's some interesting research showing that students are better judges of teacher performance than we might assume they would be. The last chapter of my book looks quite a lot at this question of how we evaluate teachers' work. And I actually think teachers themselves are some of the best judges of their colleagues and their peers. And that concept of peer review is something that really interests me.
You've spent some time with the man who is now superintendent of the Dallas Independent School District, Mike Miles, but before he was working here in Texas.
Yes, that's right. I got to know him when he was the superintendent in Harrison District 2, which was a largely Latino district in Colorado Springs.
Can you tell me about some of the takeaways from that time you spent with him about his approach?
Yeah, so his approach at that time was really largely based on using student test scores to judge teachers' work and then getting rid of the traditional teacher pay scale and really paying teachers and advancing them solely on whether they improve student performance. And I believe he has followed up with a similar agenda now with you in Texas. And I saw that there were some positive things about that, which is that he was really looking closely at the role of the teacher in the classroom. He was leading teams of administrators on, you know, visits into teachers' classrooms and looking to see if teachers' lessons were aiming high, if teachers were effective in imparting ideas to kids. And I was impressed with some of that. But at the same time, I saw that standardized tests were being created in art class and gym class in this district where he was previously. And some of those tests were just, you know, quite poor quality. They were not necessarily developmentally appropriate for young children, 5, 6, 7 years old, who were sitting for these standardized tests. And, you know, some good teachers in the districts, unfortunately, they did leave that district because they didn't want to work under those conditions.
One of the things you recommend is that we look at ending outdated protections of unions, not ending unions altogether, but looking at things like last in, first out hiring and firing policies.
Yeah, so last in, first out is the policy in which when a school, has to lay teachers off because of budget cuts, that they would get rid of the youngest and least experienced teachers first, regardless of performance. And now that we know so much more about looking at how teachers work in the classroom and really taking a look at effective practice in teaching, and there's more and more of a body of literature about what that looks like and how to observe it, I don't think a policy like that remains sensible in any way.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak next to Ken in Garland. Hi, Ken.
Hey. Good afternoon, Chris.
Hi.
I want to tell you, first of all, that I'm from El Paso, and I always get a kick when you say that.
I'm very proud to be from El Paso. What's on your mind, Ken?
Great. My primary point, Chris, was that my three sisters are teachers. My wife's an assistant principal. I've taught at the college level for about 20 years plus. I've met literally thousands of teachers. And I don't think they want open monetary rewards and recognition. Yeah, there are a few, I admit. But I think that most teachers kind of seek an egalitarian base. They want the opportunity to perform as a team, and they much would prefer, I think, team recognition.
What do you think, Dana?
I actually agree with that, and one of the things I write about in Chapter 10 in the book is the concept of collaborative workplaces for teachers, and that in terms of recognizing teacher leadership, it should be within a collaborative team, and I totally agree.
You also say it's important, and this is something that we often forget, teachers need some time among their adult colleagues. They can't simply go into the classroom all day, shut the door, and then leave at 4 o'clock.
Right. And this speaks to the caller's point. One of the things we know about American public school teaching in comparison to teachers in other nations is that our teachers spend much more of their day in front of kids and less of the day collaborating with other adults. And this doesn't really work very well because when one teacher is doing a great lesson or has picked up a great strategy, there's very little sort of systems in place to teach that to the teacher in the classroom next door. And this is something that through collaboration and planning time for teachers can be addressed.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Jim on the line in Wiley. Hi, Jim.
Hey, how are you?
Great, thank you.
Your lady just mentioned a second ago that teachers in the Dallas area are, I forget what she said, $90,000 a year, I think is what she said. My wife was a teacher for 15 years, and I'm sure she didn't make anywhere near that.
Well, I think that was Dana's point, is that it's very, very difficult to get to the point that you're making the top salary. And is that the case, Dana, in a lot of districts around the country? Like, you can name off the absolute apex of a potential salary, but only a tiny fraction of teachers are actually able to earn that?
Right. And we know from Washington, D.C., where they had this very reform-minded Chancellor, Michelle Rhee, that instituted a pay-for-performance plan somewhat similar to what you're trying in Dallas. We know that a tiny percentage of teachers achieved the top salary there that was so often cited in the media, which was $130,000 per year in that city. In New York City, where it still remains the case that years in the classroom is the biggest driver of teacher salary, it takes many, many decades to get those big six-figure paychecks. So whether it's because the system is set up to only let a few people through that door, or it takes a very, very long time to get through it. Either way, few teachers are earning those top salaries.
So many of the things that feel very modern to us today in terms of the education reforms that we think might work all have this shared element of silver bullet optimism. And your book is a reminder that a silver bullet is unlikely to work. Can you talk about why we continue to believe maybe there's one thing we can change to fix education?
I think that's a really good question. I think we're eager in this country, given the weakness of our social safety net outside of our schools, to find a fix for poverty and inequality within the sphere of education. And so if we're only really going to be looking at schools, and we're not going to be looking at things like, you know, say, raising the minimum wage across the board, then we really kind of come to schools with this this zeal for reforming them. And because oftentimes it is corporate philanthropists who've earned their money in the private sector who are the ones introducing ideas to the system, they again and again settle on some similar ideas over the decades, whether it's merit pay tied to kids' test scores or ending tenure. All these things may move the needle in some small way, but the evidence I look at throughout history, the previous decades where we tried these same policies, show that they don't have the large impact that we're looking for. And that's one of the reasons why I'm interested in teachers collaborating together at the ground level to share best practices. We've never tried to build systems in a way that actually encourage that type of work. Instead, we've tried these top-down reforms, the same ones, over and over again.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Dan on the line in Dallas. Hello, Dan.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead.
I am a retired nurse, and I see a lot of commonality between the issues that your author is speaking in regards to teachers, same issues we've dealt with for many, many, many years with nursing, and I wonder if she had any comment on that commonality and the problems that we face.
Interesting perspective. Thanks for your call.
Yeah, there's actually a famous sociologist who wrote a book called The Semi-Professions, and the three semi-professions he identified were teaching, nursing, and social work. And that person is Amitai Etzioni. So there's a book that you can check out that goes to exactly that point.
It is interesting that we all sort of can agree when pressed that these are incredibly challenging and incredibly important jobs, and yet still think that there's something beyond them that is more respectable.
Yeah, I mean, if you ask Americans, you know, do you respect teaching? They overwhelmingly say that they do respect teachers, that, you know, they respect teachers almost as much as medical doctors. It's one of the most highly respected professions. And yet at the political level, we have a conversation about teachers as failing. One of the things I point out in the introduction to the book is that it's the only job that President Obama consistently calls out in his State of the Union addresses as underperforming. And he says, you know, we have to stop making excuses for bad teachers. And we don't normally have the same conversation about, say, police officers, although maybe with the Ferguson controversy, we're starting to debate policing more. But, you know, what I really argue in the book is it is the expectation that we put on teachers to close inequality gaps and our concern about poverty and inequality that has led us to make teachers such a political focus.
Let's go back to the phones now. We have Ed on the line in Duncanville. Hello, Ed.
Hi. I was interested in your guest comments about tenure. The tests, the rating systems that we've got to gauge teachers to figure out who are the good ones and who are the bad ones have all failed spectacularly. And so what we see is the firing of teachers of the year in California, New York, and Dallas. And I'm curious about why we should do away with tenure when we don't have anything else that works.
What do you think,
Well,
Dana?
To be clear, I do not argue with doing away with tenure. I think it's important, actually, that teachers do have due process because they have experienced in American history wave after wave of politically motivated firings. So I think that's very important. I make a different point about last in, first out, which is that in the event of budget-related layoffs, we should look at teacher performance when making those decisions, not just at seniority. However, you know, the caller's correct. Again and again throughout history, when we've changed the evaluation systems that we use to judge teachers' work, we see that, you know, over 90%, sometimes 95%, 97, 99% of teachers are rated effective, that we have trouble instituting teacher evaluation systems that truly distinguish between teacher performance. And one of the reasons that that is, and it sounds banal, but it's really true historically, is that these systems require a lot of time from administrators, from principals, and they are heavy in paperwork and spreadsheets and data. And we create very complex systems that it's actually difficult to enact with any fidelity to the original reform idea that motivated them.
Do you think there is something convenient about the fact that we can point to the education system as the source of inequality in adulthood and therefore not pay much attention to other underlying factors that might contribute to people doing more or less well economically? In other words, does the fact that, politicians can blame teachers allow them to let a lot of other failures off the hook?
Yeah, absolutely. And I trace this trend politically from the 19th century till today. You know, in the early 20th century, reformers were talking a lot more about bad teachers at the time than they were talking about some really basic things like the fact that kids weren't even required to go to school after age 12 or the fact that there weren't anti-child labor laws at the time. So oftentimes we see anxiety about inequality kind of directed toward teachers instead of to more controversial reforms. And I mentioned the minimum wage. I think that's one today that has kind of, you know, often been lost in the debate as we're arguing about teachers.
Is there any way to know whether kids are leaving, say, 12th grade today more or less prepared for life than they did half a century ago?
This is a really good question, and it's difficult to answer because we don't have a lot of sort of tests that have remained consistent over the decades that would allow us to compare today's students to yesterday's students. But the best one we have is called the NAEP test, the National Assessment of Educational Progress. And it is a federal sort of national test. It has no stakes attached to it, so the scores don't mean anything. It's just a research tool. And what that suggests is that performance is basically just about flat since the 1980s, that there hasn't been any big leaps. We're closing the achievement gap a little bit between the races and classes, but we're not making as much progress as we wish, and those achievement gaps are still there.
Journalist Dana Goldstein is a staff writer at the Marshall Project and author of the new book, The Teacher Wars, A History of America's Most Embattled Profession. Dana, thank you so much for making time for us today.
My pleasure. It was a great show.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer with help on the phones today from Christina Ulsh. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and if you'd like to email the show, that address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.